I try to do two types at once. That's okay. It is now. Okay, thanks. So I think here you're starting to get at the reason why you would update a piece like this. I mean, I think in a real basic way, people want to ask you when they look at your career, why would you do this to our classics?
Well, it's so strange. I think it's because most people have this sad sense that the classics don't belong to them, that the classics are somehow, on a high shelf just out of reach. And in fact, each composer, Mozart, Wagner, Verdi, Stravinsky, wanted a deep connection with the audience. I mean, you don't go to the trouble of writing an opera if you don't want someone to hear it and engage with it at the most complete level. There are levels of these operas that we will never be able to engage with. There are things that we will never be able to understand because we simply weren't alive when they were written, and we will never know really what they mean. At the same time, there are other levels that allow you to get under the skin of the musical structure and begin to appreciate the characters and, yes, even the situation. I think one of the hardest things is most people truly don't know very much about 12th century court life. So when you present a scene of Amour Courtois of the 12th century, it doesn't say a whole lot to most audiences. For that matter, Wagner didn't know very much about it and didn't really care. Wagner was busy frying his own fish, which were, in his view, completely contemporary. He was describing his own love life and the way he was cheating on his wife and his own, strange sense of damnation and his own strange hope that he would be saved because he was a great composer. And so Tannhäuser is a terribly autobiographical piece, and the audience that first saw it was really aghast at how upfront Wagner was about it. It felt like a People magazine article. It was this glaring thing right in your face about people who have illicit love affairs. So I must say Igor Stravinsky's response once to people who are upset with him for reorchestrating Tchaikovsky into a new ballet was, you respect, I love. And the difference between, keeping a respectful distance and just going in and treating the composer as if he were alive, which, if we're still playing his music today, he is.
I know that if Barbara Walters was here, she would ask you, if Wagner could see your production, what would he think about it? It's hokey, but you're sort of getting at that, aren't you? You
Right. I
think
mean,
it's.
I must say, if Wagner could see the production, I think he would be recomposing. I think he'd say, wait a minute, wait a minute, I can take that farther. I think, Wagner would be revising right and left. He always insisted that the primary effect had to be theatrical and that the music had to serve the drama. And I think he would probably say, if we're going to do it this way, all right, let me extend that bit here, and we can cut this whole section because it's not helping you.
Now, would you carry that to these other productions you've done? You've done Mikado in a 20th century version. You've
I've
done.
never done anything that's not set in the 20th century because it's the only century I know. I mean, it's the only century I've lived in. And again, it's the only way I can testify to the authenticity of what is taking place on stage. None of us ever wore a powdered wig, and carried a 5-foot cane and had lace sleeves coming out of our waistcoat. We just don't know what it would be like to wear those shoes because we never lived in those shoes. How people really lived who wore those costumes, we can't imagine. And you can't wear those costumes for a week and then imagine it. What is it like to spend your life in those corsets? It's something we can't even begin to imagine. And so I prefer to at least leave it to people's imagination. I mean, those who are interested in a period piece are perfectly free to imagine it. And there's nothing I do that prevents them from imagining a perfect period production. And in the meantime, the rest of us don't have to creep around the back door. We can enter the front door.
Two things that you've reminded me of here. One is, interestingly enough, I've been interviewing some people involved in the Romeo and Juliet production here. I don't know if you've seen it
Sure,
at the Goodman,
I absolutely did, yes.
And that's, very much the same story here. And what the actor who plays Romeo said was just that about the costume, that he did a more conventional Romeo somewhere else a few years ago and ended up wearing these tights and doublets around for, you know, weeks at a time, trying to figure out what you do with them when you take them off at night, or how you get them out of the laundry, or like all the everyday things. And he said that was an obstacle for him in portraying it. Have you also heard these kinds of comments from actors and singers in your opera? Do you find that it's more real to them and then therefore to the audience?
Most opera singers, of course, are used to walking around wearing, about 5 tons of velour. And when you actually put them in something that they don't have to sweat to death in, they're usually grateful. But more than that, very seriously, I think a lot of people who worked on this production and who have done Tannhäuser frequently before didn't know what the story was before this. I mean, I think... the singers have been really wonderful, and Håkan Håkegaard and Richard Cassley, and who have done many Tannhäusers, you know, have really come to it with a completely different sense of depth and commitment. Once they understood where it was going, they realized it gave them permission to really mean it. And suddenly it wasn't this abstract concert in costume, you know, where everyone's pretending all night. They didn't have to pretend. They could go on stage and be it.
Mm-hmm. That may well be your answer to my next question, but I'll let you try to answer it separately. There's criticism that this can be overdone, that it's just so trendy now to update the classics. And of course, here we have Romeo and Juliet now in the Little Italy, and we have Tannhäuser and Jimmy Swaggart, and that it's just becoming hip to do that, maybe losing sight of rationale. I can sense that you're not losing sight of your rationale. How do you know when you take it too far is really
the
question.
I mean, the main point about art is you can do anything badly. You can do a conservative production badly. You can do a progressive production badly. It doesn't matter. In either case requires genuine artists, or else it's junk. And it doesn't have to do with ideology. It has to do with skill and artistry and seriousness. And I've seen... Every once in a while, it's very infrequent, but every once in a while you see a production done in period costumes that has complete integrity, and it's beautiful. It's very rare, but it can happen. It just is a question of how great the artist is. In this case, I must say I don't really update. I mean, what I basically do is try and move in two directions at once. There are as many elements of medieval art in this production as there are of contemporary art. All of the spatial relationships and set pieces are taken from medieval paintings, and the sense of dramatic time relationships comes from medieval mystery plays. And there are lots of staging positions and gestures come from German medieval wood sculpture altarpieces, or Carolingian manuscripts. We did enormous amounts of research in order to put this on. The entire set is a giant illuminated manuscript with everything lit from behind. It's all made out of plexiglass so that everything is about qualities of light which irradiate through the image. We have done an enormous amount of research. The point is the audience shouldn't have to. The point is... I'm interested to take the audience into the world of a medieval painting. In fact, principles of medieval spatial organization have everything to do with the way Picasso painted a violin in a newspaper on a table. Basically, medieval perspectival draftsmanship is connected to cubism and is connected to showing several sides of an object at once, is connected to... tilting the picture plane so it comes right into the viewer's face, rather than presenting the Renaissance illusion of deep perspective, which of course is complete falsification of the way the eye actually works, and the sense that all decisions made by a medieval painter are made primarily through spiritual considerations rather than material ones. You painted something not based on what it looks like, but based on its spiritual importance and identity. And I think that is very much the direction that the most important modern art in our period has taken. So in a way, this production that is set in the 20th century meets the 13th century very comfortably And I would not be satisfied with it if it were just the 20th century. I mean, I must say, productions like that Romeo and Juliet irritate me a little because that's not quite enough. It's not accurate enough to say, okay, this could take place in Little Italy in 1930. Of course it could and did, no doubt. But it also took place in the Elizabethan period. You know, and what's interesting about drama is that it thrives on anachronism, is that Shakespeare, you know, knew that there were no clocks in ancient Rome. It's not a mistake that he wrote in Julius Caesar the line about the clocks. It's that what is interesting about drama is for 3 hours we were able to live in all periods simultaneously. We're able to abrogate the rules of time and space. We're able to remove distance between ourselves and our ancestors and commune with them.
And you think this production of Romeo and Juliet draws a line, too much of a line between the two time periods? You
don't feel that? I just think it's, I mean, this, don't put this on the air. Michael is just not experienced enough a director to know how to make the interaction beautiful and deep between the present, the 30s, and Shakespeare.
What would you say on the air?
How they all have to hold a balance.
If we can't put that on the air, how would you describe it? I think this is a good example.
I will. I'll say that. This is for attribution. I think most productions that I see that are updated are only updated. And that's just not enough. It's not the whole story. I mean, what is interesting is not only that we see this in our own period, but that we understand that something that we see in our own period also pertains to the 1590s. And it's the simultaneity of that that is theatrical and beautiful. And the greater level of artistry, and I must say it's not easy, it just takes years and years to be able to do it with subtlety and grace, is to allow the audience to exist simultaneously in their own lifetime and in the lifetime of people who have lived on the earth before them.
And you don't think that taking Wagner's words or Shakespeare's words and putting them in a current setting is all that there is to that?
That's just not adequate, because it doesn't respect that there's lots in those words that has nothing to do with the current setting. And again, most current setting, I mean, I think what was a difficulty with Romeo and Juliet was how flat and blank the sets were. So much less interesting than the acting. Mm-hmm. And that's because the sets had their only assignment to try and do Chicago in the 1930s. You know, and they needed one other assignment to be more complex. I mean, the interesting thing, you know, it's that quote I always think of is the Einstein quote of everything should be stated just as simply as possible and no simpler.
What other assignment would you have given them, the sets?
Well, I don't want to critique Romeo and Juliet on the air, but, I mean, the sets should have had more to do with real Chicago back porches, which they didn't. Mm-hmm. It was not, the texture was not right, the color was not right, and the proportions were not right. Mm-hmm. And that would have been a start. And then, I don't know, I mean, I'd have to really work on it, but it was approximated. And I try not to approximate anything in a show, because the only issue in drama is not whether it's conservative or avant-garde, but whether it's exact. You know, how precise is it to its vision? Every detail you get right counts. Every detail you fudge counts against you. Acting is the same way. Every moment that feels bang on is fine. Every moment that feels fuzzy or half-baked or half-hearted or half-believed or half-conceived will not do and has to be removed from the production. And so you have to work very hard to get a context that is deep enough to encompass the range of human experience that's being discussed in one of these masterpieces.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why they didn't make the houses brick, for instance.
For example. It drives me crazy.
I
went berserk about that. Yeah. I went berserk. To get it that wrong, to go that far and get that much right and then to get that much wrong, it was just crazy.
I'm talking with Rob. He said it looked like the Old West more
yeah,
than like
no,
a Chicago
it's pathetic.
Street. It was too bad. I know what you mean, but I wanted to hear you say it. Most of my questions you answered so quickly by yourself, of course, which is fine. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other things you've done. The Mikado I mentioned, The Marriage of Figaro. I assume there are some operas that wouldn't hold up under this. Some things that, you know, that don't fit your formula in some way, don't speak to this generation.
I have been very fortunate in that I have done no schlock. When I get in the room with something, it's a masterpiece like Don Giovanni, where, you know, it is absolutely as valid today as the day it was written. There is a lot of schlock that clogs the opera repertoire that I think was basically irrelevant when it was new and is even less relevant 100 years later. and that is just plain schlock and will always have to be done as a concert in costume because it has no deeper vitality. The happy thing in my life is really I'm going to spend the rest of it. I'll finish a Mozart cycle because we've done the Mozart de Ponte operas now and we'll go on to do the rest. And that's something I've spent 10 years on, and I can't stop with that. But apart from the Mozart cycle, I will be devoting the rest of my time to new operas. It's enough of the old ones. It's time now. We have as distinguished a group of composers living today as have been alive at any time in the history of the world. It's time now to get a bunch more classics written, and let's write them in this generation.
Is that along the lines of Nixon in China?
Nixon in China is our first at bat, and did not badly.
Okay. All right, that's all my questions. Anything we didn't cover that you would like
you
to throw in?
No, that's
okay.
Great.
Okay.
That's great. Thanks a lot. And I'm sorry
you.
It was such a big deal getting me here.
Oh,
but
no.
We did it.
It worked. And that was
we
the,
did it.
That's the important part. Right. So I'm glad that you could make it.
I think we're ready. Yep, we're recording. My first question is how Tannhäuser came about. You know, as I was reading this, it's as if it's Artis's idea.
Oh, completely.
Okay, explain to me.
I would not in a million years have done Wagner's Tannhäuser. It's something that I liked a lot when I was 15 years old and really haven't thought about since. I've really been working on modern music or on the 18th century, and Wagner really doesn't fit in. Artis Krenick had a production originally that was to be directed by the great, great German director Klaus Michael Gruber, a real poet. It would have been his American debut. And for various reasons, at the last minute, he had to cancel. And suddenly they were left 6 months out with no Tannhäuser production. And, you know, in the world of opera, everything is booked 3 years ahead minimum. So this was a big deal. So Artis called me and said, could you possibly do a Tannhäuser for us? And this was on 6 months' notice, which, of course, in my schedule was also a little tricky because I was directing about 150 things at the same time. But Artis is Artis. There's only one. And I really wanted to do anything I could for her and to support her and her company. So I spent a tough week looking at Wagner again and trying to say, can I make anything of these gestures? You know, is there anything in my lifetime that is even remotely recognizable here? You know, that I could, from actual experience, put on stage in a way that it felt authentic. And late in my deliberations, the whole Jimmy Swaggart scandal broke. And I thought, well, now, this has a familiar ring. The idea that a preacher is caught, somebody who's, you know, campaigned against sin, is caught in a motel room with a prostitute, and goes back to face the congregation and is ejected for a trial period until he can properly redeem himself and repent. That outline of a story is something that every American knows, that we've read about and heard about every day for the last year. And I thought, well, that's a starting point. And of course, in this production, that's all it is. But it at least is a way in. And I think audiences have, you know, who are used to finding Wagner utterly impenetrable and very dull, are amazed that it goes by quickly. It, for once, doesn't feel like sort of acres and acres of Nebraska flatlands, but you actually get some sense that there's action and that the story has significance and that the participants are not only sincere, but passionately wild-eyed in their devotion. And that you need to put Wagner over, believe me. And so I must say that it's worked out well in the sense that the public has been able to really come to this opera in a direct way, with very little standing between them and what's on stage.
That was really my next question. How has it affected the audience? You've come in for almost every show, haven't you?
Oh, yes. I don't like to miss these. I mean, I do my work once the audience comes. I mean, because you spent all these weeks in rehearsal trying to say, well, maybe this would be the solution here. But it's not till the audience is there that you know. And I start changing things and, you know, working things once I have the first audience. And, of course, in opera, unlike theater, there are no previews. You go on opening night, and that's it. And audiences have been so warm and so unanimous in their acceptance of this. So unanimous in their acceptance of this. Of course, opening night, there were a few boos, but we know these were placed, and these were hired hands of various neo-Nazi fringe survivalist groups.
We know this.
This is clear. Other than that, there's been nothing but nonstop public acclaim.
Okay, we'll take your word for it for now, I suppose. Then maybe you can explain a little more directly how you pull this off. In what way does it serve as a starting point? Tell us comparisons between the traditional version and yours. Give me a few ideas of how you pull it off.
It's hard to describe the traditional staging of Tannhäuser because I've never really seen it all. When I saw it at the Met, I fell asleep during each act. And so there are large stretches that I simply cannot to this day account for. On the other hand, some members of this cast were in the Met production, and so they've told me what happens. So I have a little bit of a sense. But it's still vague. Lots of people walk around in vaguely medieval velveteen robes and sweat profusely under variously gently shifting lights. Some of them are holding harps. Every once in a while, somebody has a staff. The sets are sort of pretty watercolors of woodland scenes interacting with, some architecture. They shift kind of gently. The Venus scene is particularly hilarious. It features extremely ample soprano swathed in various layers of diaphanous hoo-ha. Now, and of course the Met Ballet prancing about.
So describe, maybe if I can just pull your train of thought a little bit, what's your Venus scene like?
Well, we start in something that could be the motel room. There are all these teenage girls running through the halls and giggling, you know, like every motel you've ever stayed at. And Tannhäuser keeps waking up in the middle of this, and he keeps thinking, imagining them in their bathing suits. They're probably by the horrible little pool outside his window. And then he imagines them naked. And they're running around, and they're giggling, and they keep waving to him and say, come on, have fun. And then we see Venus, who is a very, you know, sad middle-aged prostitute. This is probably the biggest fish she's ever caught. And he kind of wants to leave, but she doesn't want to let him go. And yet she doesn't know how to make him happy because, as at least her testimony in the Swaggart situation, apparently he never laid hands on her. You know, and it's this strange thing of you can see that this man is deeply conflicted. You know, and doesn't really, is not on some wild sex spree, but is already, is carrying an enormous burden of guilt and repression. And so the scene is very sad and strangely tender in a repressed way. She doesn't know how to make him happy, what it is she can really do for him.
So this, it sounds to me like you're focusing so much more on the character than on the scene. Is that the major difference?
Well,
it's not a mood,
I think it's very important, you know, to be specific in opera. Opera is the most specific art form. I mean, a score has so much information in it. There are all of these notes on a page. It's more information than you get from a play or a novel or a painting. I mean, there's just enormous amount of very specific moment-to-moment information. So when I direct opera, I try and work with the performers to get something that feels terribly specific as the musical language. Because music, of course, is the most specific way to say anything. It's far more specific than words. And so one tries to make a stage image that meets the music in its specificity.
Okay, I'm going to ask Rob two questions. Are we on split track, first of all? Okay, and is my cassette rolling? No, it's not. Okay. Thanks. That's okay. We're taping it. I tried to do two takes.